Okay, good morning, CCC. How are you guys doing? Excellent. I'm glad that you are well, so am I. One of the things that I always find fairly amusing is when people, and forgive the generalization, but generally Americans say to me, "Do you think Robbie will have an accent?" And I always say, "Well, it depends what perspective you have. For me, no. For you, yes." But I think Robbie will have an accent regardless, because there's a mix of South African, American, British, Filipino, Thai. He's going to be an interesting one. That elaborate story or introduction to say that we have a guest speaker today, and because of my South African accent, I may butcher his last name, so give me a bit of grace. Greg Fruginck? No. I would have said Fruginck, but he told me the other day that's not right. Greg is here. He is the Old Testament professor from ABTS, which is the seminary that I'm currently studying through, and a few other people in our church. And Greg is here. He's preaching this morning, and his speciality, his area of knowledge and expertise is the Old Testament, and in particular Ecclesiastes. And so that's what he's going to be speaking to us on today. Earlier in the week, I was having lunch with a friend of mine from South Africa who's just finished a theological degree. And he said to me, I don't know why, but in my mind, Old Testament professors are always old guys. And I said, me too. And Greg is not an old guy, but he has an immense amount of knowledge and wisdom. And I've spent the last 4 days with him, and I've been hugely blessed in conversation with him, and I've thoroughly enjoyed just learning from you, Greg, and hearing from you. So thank you so much personally for that. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've learned a lot and probably forgotten more in the last few days than I ever knew before. Greg is in Thailand with his wife and 4 children. They live in Chiang Mai, which is where ABTS is based. And he's from Michigan originally. He spent several years in China teaching and has pastored a few churches in the U.S. as well. So Greg, I'm excited to hear from you this morning. Welcome. Let's extend a warm welcome to Greg as he comes up.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So I just taught a class on wisdom literature in the Philippines a couple weeks ago, and the average class length was 3 hours. So buckle up. Andrew said I could take as long as I wanted. So we're going to be in the book of Ecclesiastes today, but before we get there, just want to do a little bit of introduction, because it's not a super well-known book. People don't read it, and if they do, they come away discouraged usually. So it's going to be a little bit of an interesting morning. But before we get into that book itself, I want to talk a little bit about the book of Proverbs. Because when we think about the Bible and we think about wisdom literature, that's usually the book that we think about, right? So Proverbs is an easy book to read, and a lot of people read through Proverbs in a month. You can read like a chapter per day. And it's got all of these nice little nuggets of wisdom about how to raise your children, and how to not go into debt, and how to not be lazy, and you know, all of these different things. And so this is how we usually think about biblical wisdom literature. And I think it's kind of one-sided, because we come to a book like Ecclesiastes, and at least for us in the modern age, this is a book that feels much more like it was written in the modern age. Right, so we're going to start looking at this book, but it's very, very different. When we talk about wisdom, like what is wisdom in the Bible, particularly in Proverbs, it's a skill. The word itself is used of people that have skill in building things in other places in the Old Testament, and so it's skill at living life the way God intends it to be lived. So God has created the universe with wisdom as a principle, almost like gravity, you could say, like, this is how you look out and you observe. This is how things usually work. And the biblical writers write down wisdom, and cultures all over the world have seen very similar wisdom. And so it's skill at living life the way God intended it to be lived. And Proverbs is a book about how to live life when everything works the way it's supposed to. right? So we come to Ecclesiastes, and it's a book about how to understand and to live life when things don't work the way they're supposed to. That the fact that we live in a broken world, a world broken by sin, is basically the entire basis of Ecclesiastes. And so when we think about what's going on, we have the Garden of Eden, the world is created, man and woman are in the garden, but then they sin, Genesis chapter 3. And then Genesis chapter 4, something interesting happens. So there's God pronounces a curse, and he says, if you eat of this tree, you will surely die, and they eat of it, but then surprise, they don't die. They don't die, and so it's a little confusing. It maybe for us, we expect it because we have maybe grown up with these stories and we're familiar with Genesis, but they don't die, and that's a little confusing. And then we move on to chapter 4, and something interesting does happen. Someone dies, but they don't die of natural causes. Cain kills his brother Abel, so the very first death in God's creation is not just a natural death, but murder, right? And so that is unexpected. But then, after that, there's a chapter 5, and probably very few of you can tell me what Genesis chapter 5 is, because it's a genealogy, and we all just skip those because they're boring. I mean, I'm an Old Testament professor, and I think they're boring. So that tells you something, right? But the thing that's interesting about Genesis chapter 5 is it's different than some of the other ones. You read other genealogies, and it'll say, this person, the son of this person, the son of this person, the son of this person, and it just keeps going and going. But Genesis chapter 5, there's a word that shows up again and again and again, and it says, so this person lived this many years, and they had these children, and then they died. And then the next person lived this many years, they had this many children, and they died. And they died, and they died, and they died. And it just keeps going and going. And you don't see that in the other ones, because this is the punishment, the curse, right? And this is where it first shows up. All of this death is starting to appear, and Genesis 5 really takes pains to make that clear to us. So why am I talking about this? Well, a lot of people, scholars, feel that Ecclesiastes is really just kind of a reflection or even a commentary on these early chapters of Genesis, that we see what we expect the world to be like, what God has said when he created the universe, and it was good. And we expect that, and our hearts want that. We want Eden, the Garden of Eden, but that's not what we get. And so there's a lot of disappointment involved, right? So our focus verse is actually way at the end of Ecclesiastes today, but again, jumping to Proverbs, a lot of these wisdom books, they have a very clear purpose that's put forward. In Proverbs, it's at the beginning. It says, you know, this book is good for gaining knowledge and wisdom. It's for the wise. It's for the simple. It's so that people can grow. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that's the introduction of the book. Ecclesiastes has more of an introduction at the end. So it's not an introduction. It tells you what the purpose is. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says something very interesting. It says, this is what the teacher wrote in this book, and the words of the wise are like goads. And goads is like a pointy little stick that shepherds will use to get the livestock to go where they wanted to go. So goads are useful because they lead you in the path that you should go, but they're also a pointy stick, right? And no one likes being poked with a pointy stick. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says this is what Ecclesiastes is. It's a pointy stick to get us to do what we are supposed to do. And if you've read it before, you probably know it's a pointy stick. The things that it says are not comfortable, they're not happy, but they're useful for us. And so we're going to get in here, and some of these words, they hurt like a pointy stick. But let's just start out by reading the first couple verses. So if you could turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. And I'm going to do a very professorial thing, and I'll read like one verse and then stop. Okay, so just the warning here, because we're going to get into things very quickly. So it says, the words of the preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. We'll go one more verse. Sorry, two verses, and then we'll stop. And then probably a lot of your translations here now say, vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So we're going to stop right there, just to get some introduction here. Now, a very common way to view Ecclesiastes is that because of some of the things it says, like the first verse, people say this is written by Solomon, and basically what he's doing in this book is he's telling us what not to do and what not to think. And so you get to the end of the book, and it says, okay, after all is said and done, fear God and keep his commandments, which is our key verse for today. And what that's really doing is telling you that despite what he said earlier, all these things, you should really just fear God and keep his commandments. And so the end of the book kind of turns the whole book. And I don't think that's a responsible way to understand this book, because when you understand it that way, it means that as you read it, you basically can't apply it at all. You're reading all of Ecclesiastes and saying, I shouldn't think this way, I shouldn't do this. But I don't think that's the point. So the truth is, this book, we don't know who wrote it. It could have been Solomon, and the writer of the book never names himself. He just says, the teacher. I'm a teacher, and I'm going to teach you some things. Because I think even if it was Solomon, the things that he deals with are universal, and he doesn't want to limit it to a certain time and place. Okay, so that's the first big idea. The second big idea is this word, vanity. I don't like this word. And again, this is a very professorial thing that I hate doing, especially when preaching, but this word in the Hebrew is actually breath. It just means breath. And so for whatever reason, translation is hard. You know, most of you from other countries probably know at least some different languages. You understand that translation is never like one-to-one. It's always more like this, right? And so people have struggled throughout the history of translating the Bible with how to best translate this word so that we can understand it. Because if you read, I do have a translation of this that says, this is what the teacher says, merest breath, everything is breath. Well, that doesn't necessarily help us too much here. And so I want to give you kind of a picture of what this means in this book. Because I think vanity is a very old translation, all the way back to the original Latin translation of the Bible. It was the first time it showed up. That's why people often use this. But the problem is, at least in English nowadays, vanity, it doesn't have the same meaning that it has in this book. We don't use that word very often, and we don't think of it in the same way. We think of it as someone maybe that's arrogant or something like that, but that's not what it's talking about here. So when he says everything is breath, he's talking about a couple different qualities. The first one, something that may be familiar to you if you've read the Old Testament and the New Testament, where it says mankind is just like breath. He's there one day and then and passes away. So it's short. Everything life is very short. But then the other image that is here is maybe a little more helpful for us, is that if you go outside, and this doesn't really happen in Thailand, but if it's cold outside, and you go out and you breathe, you can see your breath. You know, you see the vapor. That's another translation or meaning of this word, is vapor. And the thing that's interesting, or you could think about smoke even. And you see it, and it's there, and it's something, but if you try to grab onto it, it's not something, right? It's weird. It's like one of those mind-boggling things. It is there, but it's not there, right? So that's what he's talking about, that the life is like that. It's something you try to grab onto, but when you try to grab onto it, it's kind of a mystery, like where did it go? And that's really kind of this big idea of this word in here. When we read certain passages, I'm actually just going to say breath, because I think it's gonna help us a little more to understand what he's saying. That life is mysterious, and you can't always understand exactly what's going on with it, right? So that's the big introduction after two verses. So let's get back into it. And it says, the words of the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem, breath of breaths, says the preacher, breath of breaths, everything is breath. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. See, is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It's already been in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be after those who come after. So this is a little discouraging, right? But this is his introduction to the book. And we're going to see a couple different themes throughout this book, but he starts out with this idea that life is breath. It's a mystery. You try and grab onto it, and you can't really fully understand it. And he uses this word, this breath, 38 times throughout the book. So, and this is not a huge book, so it's all over the place. And so when he first starts, he begins with this philosophical statement that he says, well, look at the world. And he starts with the sun. It comes up, it goes down, comes up, it goes down, comes up, goes down. It's always the same. The wind blows, where is it going? We don't know. And then the sea, the streams, they go into the sea, but the sea doesn't get full. Well, that's weird, right? And he's really pointing to all these ideas in nature, these cycles that happen over and over and over again. And years go by, and they keep going by, and they keep going by, and everything is the same. But at the same time, he's lamenting that for mankind, it's not that way, right? We die, we pass away, and no one remembers us, and the world keeps going on and on and on. It's the idea, like, we have these struggles to, you know, make money, build our business, make a mark on the world, and we work so hard to do all of these things, but you just go and talk to a mountain about it and see if it cares, or the ocean. It's still there, it's still going to be there. Long after you're gone, it will still be doing the same thing. And he's lamenting this. He says, this isn't right. Right? This shouldn't be that everything goes on and on and on and nothing ever changes and we just pass away. The way I think of it is that I personally, and maybe some of you are amazing people, but I personally don't even know the name of my great-great-great-great-grandfather. Or take a couple greats off of there. I don't even know his name. Right? And that's someone in my family. And over the course of maybe just 100 years, 150 years, that person is forgotten. And the teacher's saying, this isn't right. You know, that we were built, we were made to be eternal beings, to live in the Garden of Eden, to walk with God, and now we pass away. And this is not right. He looks around and he says, you see anything that's new? And while someone might say, well, there's a new iPhone. There's an iPhone before that one. And honestly, everyone, you know, people stand in line and for hours and hours to get the new iPhone. And it's the same thing as the old one. You know, it's maybe got a new few new features, but it's basically the same thing. Well, what about the internet? That's new, right? Well, we had books before that. It's the same thing, it's just faster, right? And so saying there's nothing new, like everything, it's always been here, it will always be here. And so he's really dealing with this idea. So Andrew mentioned to me that he has trouble with outlines, making clear outlines in his preaching, and people have maybe mentioned it to him kindly. And so I do have an outline for you. So the first point is living wisely when life is breath, okay? So how do you live in a world where this is what it's like, right? Life is breath, and it is painful because you can't understand it. There's nothing new. And the teacher is just asking this question, how do we live in a world that's this way? Our hearts are made for a different kind of world. C.S. Lewis, a famous author, Christian author, he said, if I have desires in my heart that nothing in this world can satisfy, it must mean that I'm made for someplace else. And that's really what the teacher is talking about here, that he looks at the things in the world and he says, ultimately, they don't satisfy. And this is where a lot of people get this idea of Solomon saying, okay, don't do what I do. Don't think this way. So we're going to jump ahead to chapter 2 to see what he has to say to us. It says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was breath. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? And I searched my heart for how to cheer my body with wine. My heart's still guiding me with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven in the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks. I planted them with all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. I had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, many concubines, delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whenever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, and my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and all the toil I had expended in my doing it. And behold, all was breath and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So again, discouraging, and this is maybe something we can get on board with as Christians. I've heard this passage preached, and basically it said, when you follow after money or career or pleasure or whatever it is that you're following after, and you do it apart from God, it's going to be disappointing to you. Now, I agree with that, but I also think that's not what the teacher is saying here. He actually says, in all of this, I retained my wisdom. That I think that when we look at what the teacher tells us in Ecclesiastes, he doesn't ever really forsake God. He is in the midst of following God, trying to find meaning in all of this. And I think that what he's saying is that he tried all of these things, not apart from God, but even following God, and it was still disappointing to him. And this is maybe a little more radical for us. But this is the idea that when you are living in a world that is broken, you cannot fully satisfy yourself. So there's a point in this book, he even says, and then I tried following wisdom, I tried seeking God, and that too was breath. And that's the kind of passage that makes us really uncomfortable, right? Because the easy Christian answer is, if you follow God, everything will be okay. But what this book says to us is that the fact is, this world is broken, and relationships are broken, and everything is going to ultimately pass away, and we need to learn how to live a life in the midst of this that still follows God, even when we don't see the ultimate and immediate reward for that. So Proverbs, we love Proverbs so much because it says if you do this, then this will happen. You're not lazy, then you'll reap the rewards of it. But what happens when you don't? What if you're not lazy and you work hard and tragedy still strikes, like Job, right? What do you do then? And that's what this book is talking about. This is the book about all of the exceptions, right? So I'm not trying to discourage everyone this morning, but the fact is we live in a world that is full of exceptions. We can live wisely and put all of our might into following God and still have it not turn out. So what do we do? What do we do with that? And that's the problem that he's struggling with. You know, the overarching idea, I think, that the teacher is asking, he's saying, he's saying, it's not supposed to be this way. This is the vision that I have that I think God has made the world for, and this is what I actually experience. And that's really challenging. That's why I said Proverbs, I think, is an easy book for us. Ecclesiastes is one that feels more true to us, I think. If we are really honest with our experience in the world, you wake up in the morning and you're tired, right? It's not supposed to be that way, especially if you have a baby. That's rough. Four kids. Four kids, and I understand. You wake up in the morning and you're tired. It's tough. You know, you drive to work and traffic is terrible, right? And the reason we get frustrated by these things is that it's not supposed to be that way. We're not supposed to be living in a world that's broken. We're not made for a world that is broken. And yet that is the world that we live in. So we have to learn how to live in that gap. You know, here's the Garden of Eden. Here's the new earth and paradise, and we live in the hole in between, right? And we have to learn how to live in that hole, and that's the real challenge. So the first step, understanding that life is breath, that the teacher, he actually at points finally begins to understand that one of the real challenges is that you experience disappointment when you're trying to understand, and when you're trying to work out, okay, so I did what I was supposed to, but it didn't work out the way it was supposed to. So where did I go wrong? I was talking with Andrew about this actually, you know, that proverb, raise up a child in the way that they should go and they will not depart from it. So I raised up the child in the way that I should have and they did depart from it. So that means I must have done something wrong, right? Well, Ecclesiastes says, no, it doesn't always work that way. there are times when you do the things you're supposed to, and it doesn't turn out the way it's supposed to. And what the teacher actually says throughout Ecclesiastes is that you don't need to try and understand it. The world is complex. The book of Job is all about this. God is still in control, but it's much more complex than we could ever fully understand. Job asked God to explain it to him, and God says, Job, if I told you, your brain would explode. Like, literally, you cannot understand the complexity of the world to say, you do this, and then this happens. There's so much more going on. And so God doesn't ever really answer Job's question because he can't, because Job is just human. And so the teacher basically tells us, don't try to find the reasons. You know, for us, we're always trying to find the reasons, right? Why am I going through this? Well, is it because I did this bad thing like 2 months ago? Or maybe I made a mistake here? Or maybe God's trying to teach me this thing or this thing or this thing? And the truth is, we don't know. You know, we cling to God, we fear God in humility and seek to follow after him, but we ultimately don't have the information. And when we try to find it out, when we try to be God, that is when we experience that frustration and disappointment. And so his first bit of advice for us, like how to live wisely, how to live well when life is breath, is you know, as much as it sounds horrible, I'm coming up here in a church preaching from the pulpit, basically just saying, enjoy the ride. You know, things are going to happen and you're not going to understand them, because that's how life is, living in a broken world. And you roll with the punches, you keep living, and we're going to get to the end. The last verse in Ecclesiastes is very clear about this. Life is good sometimes and it's bad sometimes, and you can't control which it's going to be when. And that's okay. Okay? So it's really an issue of control. Who are you going to trust? Do you want to control every outcome in your life? Because if you do, you're going to be very disappointed. You're going to be very frustrated. But if you can trust God with that, and you can take the bad and the good with joy, that's how to live life wisely, right? So the first point, how to live wisely, living well when life is breath. Next one is very close, but it's called, living life with righteous disappointment, okay? So I'm going to pick out a couple more verses. Just, we don't have time to read through all of Ecclesiastes, but I want to give you kind of a good picture here. Ecclesiastes 2:15, it's a little bit after what we just read. It said, then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is breath. So he actually says here, I hated life. It's pretty harsh for something that's in the Bible, right? I hated my life. So he continues on in verses 17 through 19. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all his breath and striving after the wind, I hated all my toil at which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. So he's lamenting this idea that ultimately, in the third point, and we're going to talk about this a little more, that the death is like a great equalizer. Ultimately, we all die, right? And the wise person, they can spend their life devoting their life to wisdom, and they're still going to die, just like the fool. You can spend your life building your business, building an amazing career, making all kinds of money, having a great house, whatever it is. Ultimately, you're going to die. Everyone dies. Genesis chapter 5. You know? And he's lamenting this fact. He's saying, well, it's not supposed to be this way. But we need to understand that it is this way, right? And so he kind of has this idea, which I think it's, if you walk away with something from this, maybe you can remember this phrase. He says it's okay to wisely hate life, okay? It is okay to do that. And I know that sounds like an odd phrase, but Jesus in the New Testament talks about righteous anger, the idea that you can be angry about something for a good reason. And I think that's what the teacher's saying. You know, this world, it's not supposed to be the way it is. It is not supposed to be this difficult. It's not supposed to be this broken. And it's okay to hate that fact. You don't have to slap on a smiley face and pretend to be happy about that. Okay, so there's a really great commentary on Ecclesiastes, and he, I think uses a great illustration of this. Like, how should you respond to this idea that life is so broken, and how do you wisely hate this injustice? And he says, imagine that, I don't know, you people from different countries here, so rather than putting out a specific sport, we'll just say sports, okay? So you're playing, I don't know what you guys are into, sportsing of some kind. So he imagine that you are coaching a children's team of some sort, whether it's football or, whatever it is you guys are into, baseball, American football, whatever. And basketball, everyone loves basketball, right? So, no, okay. Not everyone loves basketball, apparently. So, you're coaching this, and you're playing another team, and that team is just playing so dirty. Like, just, it is beyond what is acceptable. And at first, what are you going to tell those kids that you're coaching? You're saying, don't do that. Be wise. Don't play that way. And you just do your best. But the officials, the referees, they're not calling any of it. They're just letting it go completely. And in your heart, at that point, you're really starting to hate that situation, but there's nothing you can do about it. So what do you tell them? I think what the teacher is telling us when life is that way, when it's unjust and you can't do anything about it, is that you tell those kids, you go out and you play fair because it's the right thing to do. You're still gonna lose. There's nothing we can do about that. But you go out there and you play fair so that there is some kind of fairness going on out on the field or on the court. So the teacher says to us, and there's a section, a couple of verses a little later on, he says, ultimately, wisdom is not infallible. You practice it, and sometimes it doesn't work out. And that's fine. You still be wise because that's the right thing to do. You bring wisdom to the court or the field of life so that wisdom exists there, not just because if you're wise, good things will happen to you, right? So you can wisely hate life. You can look at the brokenness of the world, the injustice, and you can lament that. A great quote from that commentary I mentioned, he says, we read the news, we bury our children, murders, thefts, bribes, fists, weapons, sex, lies, and the weather patterns are used to brutalize people. We watch the world, we hate that God has created good has become like a rusty nailed playground, no longer fit for kids at play. We hate this, and the wise cannot pretend that all is well. And I think that last sentence is key. He's actually, Ecclesiastes is saying, if you're wise, you can't ignore the problems in the world. And we're in Thailand, where the sex trade is just astounding in its span. And that's not right. It's not supposed to be that way. And we can lament that. The wise should lament that. We should look out and see when someone works hard and it goes to someone else. We can hate that. We should, if we are wise, look and say, that's not how it's supposed to be. And by extension, we should do something about it if we can, right? That is what wisdom is in a broken world. It's not looking at everything and pretending like everything is the good life. And a lot of you here are probably much better off than other people. That's just the reality. I know I am. And this can be a harder truth for us. When life is going well, to read a book like Ecclesiastes, you're like, well, not me. It doesn't apply to me. But it does. Maybe you are receiving good gifts from God right now, and so you need to take some kind of action to look out and to open your eyes to the injustice in the world and in your own life, in your own workplace, in your own family, because all of those things are broken. No matter how hard you want them to be perfect, they're still going to be broken. Right? So we need to, as wise people seeking to follow God, open our eyes to those facts and to do something about it. Yeah? So living wisely when life is breath, living wisely or living well with righteous disappointment, then the last point, living well in the face of death. So one of the main points, which I haven't read any of the passages so far, one of the main points of Ecclesiastes is death. I mentioned it briefly. It's the great equalizer. You have rich, you have poor, you have wise, you have the fool. everyone dies. And there's even a point where he says, a man is just like animals, you know, man and animal, they both die. You know, that death is the great equalizer. So what does it have to teach us? Because he doesn't only lament death, but he uses death in Ecclesiastes to teach us. He says, we have so much to learn from death. There's a passage in chapter 7, it says, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. Well, of course, we would all rather go out to dinner with our friends than to a funeral. But the teacher says to us, you have so much more to learn from a funeral than you do from a dinner with your friends. And in my life, I found this to be very true. I had an uncle just a couple years ago that died. I didn't really know him very well. He was a very quiet man. He was a farmer. And so he died, and I went to his funeral, and there weren't a lot of people there. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't know him super well, so maybe this was a guy that, you know, he really did end up touching people's lives in some way, but that wasn't the case, and I know it sounds horrible to say, but it seemed like people were struggling to say anything about him, really. Not just good things, but just anything, because he was just a very quiet guy and did his work, and that was about all you could say about him. A couple weeks later, just like 2 or 3 weeks later, the wife of the music minister in our church, she died very suddenly. She had been sick for about 6 weeks. She went in and was diagnosed with cancer. She lived for 4 weeks after that and died. It was very fast. And I went to her funeral, and again, I had talked to her maybe just a handful of times, like 8 to 10 times. She was very, very kind, and there were 1,500 people at that funeral. And she was not a well-known person. And there were more people that could have come or wanted to come if they could. And just the thousands of people that she touched, not anyone famous, no, none of you would have ever heard of her, but she wasn't boisterous, she wasn't, you know, like, but she was kind, and she was gentle, and she was wise, and she touched people's lives. And that, to me, you know, this was a couple years ago, and I still think regularly about her funeral, because it taught me things about what's important in life, right? So the house of mourning has a lot more to teach you than the house of feasting. Death has many things to teach you. And so the first thing that I think we can say that death is in Ecclesiastes, death is a surgeon. It cuts out the parts that we don't need. When we start to look at what death has to teach us, very early on, those passages, the passage I read at the beginning in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, he basically said, you know, everything passes away. So if you know everything passes away, that the money that you've made is not going to last, that the empire of business or whatever it is, or the perfect family, ultimately those things are going to pass away, it causes you to ask, what is really important? What is truly important in my life? And what can I do without? The teacher in chapter 2, he says, I tried everything. I tried drink, I tried sex, I tried money, I tried building my little empire, I was powerful, I was wise, and I was still not happy. Right? So what is important? Cut out the rest. And that's what death can teach us, because it is that great equalizer. Death is a teacher. This is what I just mentioned. You know, you look at that passage in Ecclesiastes 9, 7 through 10, it talks about this a lot, but that idea that when we go to the house of mourning, we go to funerals, it has a lot to teach us about what's important in life, because someone else has reached that end that everyone will reach. And so it makes you think, what legacy am I going to leave? What are people going to say about me? Who am I pouring into? You know, do I expect that I will have 1,500 people at my funeral? And the thing was, she didn't, that's not what she was living for, right? She wasn't saying, when I die, I would really love if there are 1,000 people at my funeral. She was living wisely. She was living kindly. And it can teach us a lot. So death is a teacher. And then last of all, this is, thankfully, you guys are going to be so happy. This is where it starts to get a little happier, okay? Because I mentioned before that Ecclesiastes, it's not all negative. And this is part of the problem that people have with this book. It's hard to mesh these two things together because there are these passages that scholars call carpe diem passages, seize the day, right? That they'll just pop up, it seems almost like randomly in Ecclesiastes, where he'll say, everyone dies, this world is horrible, and you can wisely hate this world, but be happy, right? And so it's kind of like, what do we do with this? But death is a gift giver. So let's turn to Ecclesiastes 9, 7 through 10. And I'm actually going to go back a little bit. So we're going to start in chapter 9, verse 3. It says, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. The same event happens to all, and that's death. Also, the hearts of the children of men are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But he who is joined with the living has hope, and a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. So that's a little discouraging, right? But then he says, right after that, okay, if dead people, they're dead, they don't get anything anymore. It equalizes everyone. And then he says, go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Well, that seemed like a big turn, right? It's a like whiplash from that change in ideas. It says, let your garments always be white, let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your breath, your vain life he's given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and your toil which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. So that's kind of all mixed up there. He's like, so guys, this is very depressing. Everyone dies, but be happy anyway. Because the greatest thing that you can do is in this life that is ultimately breath is accept God's gifts. He says, go, have fun with your spouse, put on nice clothes, put oil on your head, eat food, enjoy good food. Okay, so what is going on here in these Carpe Diem passages? He's saying, God gives us good gifts. One of the other ones, there's about five or six of these passages in Ecclesiastes. So God gives good gifts for us to enjoy, but we don't know when he's going to give them, right? And when we're trying to force God's hand to make these things happen in our lives, that's when we experience so much frustration and disappointment. So life, it's broken, and it's difficult. And we need to learn to live with that. We also need to understand that God sometimes very often gives us good gifts, and it's okay to enjoy them, but don't count on them all the time. Don't expect that God will constantly pour these gifts on your life so that all that is in your life is constantly enjoyment and happiness. It's not an expectation we can have from this world. Now, this is obviously a very different teaching than like a prosperity gospel or a prosperity teacher, because that's basically what they're teaching, but it says, it's hard to live in this world, but you can still enjoy God's gifts. And you should. It is our duty to enjoy God's gifts. Okay? So death is a surgeon that cuts out all of these things that are unnecessary. It is a teacher that teaches us how to live, but it's also a gift giver. The fact that we know that we are going to die gives us power to enjoy the things that are good. Right? So that brings us to the end. If you want to turn with me to chapter 12, verse 13, and it's taken us a while to get here, but there's a reason I went through the whole book to get us to this place, because it really helps us to understand what he's saying here. So starting in verse 11, actually, is the verse I mentioned at the beginning. It says, the words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are collected sayings. They're given by one shepherd. So basically he says, the teacher, he's just said a lot of difficult things in this book. You know, I'm sure when you walk away from this service today, enjoy might not be the word you'll choose to use to describe this sermon. And that's fine, I'm okay with that. But it's a pointy stick, right? It pokes us to make us go where we're supposed to go. And then he says in verse 13, he says, the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, every secret thing, whether good or evil. So you reach the end, and if you've been following what Ecclesiastes is saying, what the teacher is saying, this is not surprising. You know, as I said, one of the one of the ways sometimes people understand this passage is that basically what it's telling us is, in spite of what the teacher has said, fear God and keep his commandments. So all of that stuff, it was just negative. Don't worry about it. You just follow God and keep his commandments. But if you've been paying attention to what this book is saying, he's saying the same thing, right? He's saying there is bad in life and there is good in life. That doesn't change our responsibility, right? In the bad, in the good, what do? Fear God and keep his commandments. A more modern way of saying it, maybe, you know, a couple years ago, probably a lot of you are familiar, you've seen that poster that resurfaced from World War II in the UK. It says, keep calm and carry on. That's basically what this is saying. You want to come to the end of, this is the end of the matter, this is what the teacher wants you to know. How do you live in a broken world? Keep calm and carry on. Follow God and keep his commandments. Even when things are bad, follow God and keep his commandments. When they're good, follow God and keep his commandments. That is the duty of man. You take the good and you take the bad and you follow him. Now, this is like one of those false endings where you guys are really excited. You think I'm wrapping it up and then I go for like 20 more minutes. Just kidding. No, just kidding. We are going to jump to the New Testament, though. So if you could turn with me to Romans chapter 8, please. Romans chapter 8, and we're going to start in verse 18. So it says, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Now there's a word in there where it says the creation itself was subjected to futility. Without getting into all of the language issues, that word is the same word that's in Ecclesiastes. Okay? In the Greek version of the Old Testament, that word futility that is in Romans is the exact same word that is the same word as breath, all through Ecclesiastes. So there are a number of scholars that feel that Paul, writing Romans here, is actually explicitly trying to get us to think of Ecclesiastes. And so what is this saying? I mean, this is a much more familiar passage to us, but it keeps that tension. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing the glory that is to be revealed in us. And then it goes on, the creation itself will be set free, in verse 21, from its bondage to corruption, obtain freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So I love this passage because I think that it is really talking about Ecclesiastes. It's much more well known to us, but it keeps the same tension. You know, we have a tendency, I think, as at least American Christians I can speak for, but I think in my other experiences I've seen this too, the Christians have the tendency to want to slap a happy face on things. Say, we have hope. And so you come to Romans and say, well, because we have the hope of Jesus, that completely negates Ecclesiastes, right? Because we have hope, so we can be happy even in all these things. But Romans chapter 8, it tells us that it is still hard, right? That we do have sufferings. And yeah, they're not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed. But that doesn't change the fact that we're suffering now. And that the world itself is even broken. That it is groaning. You know, it is in bondage. And we have hope, right? And so there's that tension about the world in which we live. We believe that Jesus offers us ultimate hope. We believe in the redemption and the resurrection of our bodies, the new earth. And those things are amazing, but we don't live there now. There's a theological term that lots of theologians use called already not yet, right? So we are already redeemed, but not fully redeemed. And so Romans chapter 8, Ecclesiastes, is all about the not yet, right? We have hope, and we can live in that hope, but we're not quite there yet. And so we still live in a world with problems, with hurt, with disease, with injustice. So how do we respond to that? How do we live well in the face of that? And that's really the book of Ecclesiastes. As I said at the beginning, it's a book. It's an entire book. So to to tell you everything about this book, I can't really do it in this amount of time. I encourage you to go read it. Giving you some guidelines, I think I'll help you. And personally, and this is maybe just because I'm demented, but this is like Andrew mentioned, this is my area of study. I love Ecclesiastes because in it I see a really refreshing honesty that, not that the rest of the Bible is dishonest, but it speaks to life in a much different way than a lot of different parts of the Bible do. And with an honesty that is so refreshing to me, I hope it is to you. And I hope that you don't go away discouraged by this, but encouraged, because that is, I think, ultimately the goal of the teacher of Ecclesiastes, is to say, yes, things are bad, but we still have a lot to learn, and there's still a lot of good. And by acknowledging and grabbing hold of those bad things and those difficulties and that brokenness, it allows us to better enjoy God's gifts, to better see how to live wisely in his world. Okay? So that's the end of the matter. Keep calm and carry on. So I'll just close this in a word of prayer, and then God, thank you so much for all that you are, for all that you've done. And we thank you for this book of Ecclesiastes that is difficult. It can be hard to understand, and the truths that are in it are like pointy sticks, but we ask that you would use this book to teach us how to live wisely in a world that is broken, that isn't the way it's supposed to be, that you would give us strength and knowledge and hope to hold on to you, to know that you are sovereign, that you have a plan, but that it is so much more complicated than we could ever know. And we ask that you would put in our hearts the strength to trust you in that. And we thank you again that we can come together and worship you together in community, that we can follow you with a joined purpose, and that we can love you and know you. And we ask that you would put it in our hearts to love you and to know you more today. And we pray all these things in your name, Jesus.